data from the rest of the world, where lung cancer still ranks among the highest in incidence among all cancers, and the death rate is not much better than in the US. Let's talk about prognosis. So prognosis of lung cancer is dependent on a few things, most notably the histology or the type of lung cancer, the stage, and patient characteristics. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but just focusing on the stage, because this will be part of this talk, and we see that with the advancing stage, we have a decrease in the five-year survival in our lung cancer patients. That said, histology, stage, and patient characteristics not only dictate prognosis, but they also dictate treatment. So in our day and age, treatment of lung cancer has come along pretty well. And with personalized targeted therapy, we no longer talk about non-small cell versus small cell lung cancer. But we don't even talk about different types of histologic types of non-small cell lung cancer. We have to go all the way at determining if we have any molecular changes or genotypic mutations that will also dictate therapy to these patients. Some of the few mutations that we look at, such as the EGFR gene mutation, the ALK, the ROS1, these patients, if found to have these mutations, will be candidates for further therapy with TK inhibitors. That said, we're going to see a lot of patients that come into clinic where they have a chest x-ray like that or a CT scan like that, maybe even a PET scan. So what do we do? We first have to talk to ourselves and make sure that and ask ourselves if this is cancer. If this is cancer, is this really lung cancer or is this metastatic disease? We don't stop there. We have to determine the histology. And like I just discussed, we have to search even further along and see if there's any molecular markers. But even more importantly, we have to determine the stage of that patient's cancer. So our goal when we talk about diagnosing and staging lung cancer, we really want to look at the big picture. We don't want to just diagnose cancer. We don't want to just stage lung cancer, but we want to do it in a quick way. We want to do it in an efficient way. We want to do it in an accurate way. And importantly enough, we have to do it with the least invasive method. So we have a lot of different modalities of lung cancer staging. Okay, we can do non-invasive testing, such as imaging with CAT scans or PET scans. There's invasive staging with mediastinoscopy and maybe a little less invasive staging with EBUS and EUS, thoracentesis, to name a few. Everybody who's getting evaluated for lung cancer or lung malignancy has to undergo chest imaging. So we usually start with imaging of the chest by using a contrast-enhanced CT scan. And if indicated, we move on to look at a PET scan or a PET CT, integrated PET CT scan. These are good tests, non-invasive tests to start with. The problem is with the sensitivity. We don't have high sensitivity in CT chest to determine the presence of mediastinal involvement of lung cancer. So we look at that and we see sensitivity of around 55%. Much better with PET scanning with a sensitivity of around 80%. Still not enough. So we have to follow up our imaging with a more invasive workup of the mediastinum to see if lung cancer has spread to that area of the chest. So we can actually group the chest imaging by CT scan into four major groups that will help us define the next step in the workup of our patients. So group one, or the first group, is a fairly easy group. It's a group where the mediastinum does not have to be staged because the cancer is actually invading the mediastinum, and we say that the mediastinum involvement is implied. And all we need to do is diagnose cancer. We don't need to stage the mediastinum. The second group of image findings are actually when we look at the CT scan and we see discrete mediastinal lymphadenopathy. That automatically qualifies the patient to undergo invasive testing. Okay, so this is pretty straightforward. C and D are part of the same group, and they involve a group of patients whose CAT scans have evidence of N1 involvement of the hilar lymph nodes or interlobar lymph nodes together with a peripheral lung mass. The mediastinum in this group can be normal, actually, and if the patient has a larger centrally located mass, then also falls within that group despite having normal or non-FDG avid lymph nodes. So these two fall into the same category, and they both require invasive staging. And then we're left with the final group, which is labeled here as E, and we have a mostly a clinical stage 1A cancer with a peripheral nodule and normal mediastinum. So nodules usually less than 3 centimeters, peripheral, not centrally located, and a really normal mediastinum by chest imaging. These patients are the only patients that can actually head to surgical treatment without mediastinal staging. That said, we're going to get these patients. We're going to get a patient with mediastinal adenopathy, and we have to go from there. So the first thing we need to think about is, how can I stage this patient with the least invasive method possible? Answer, EBUS or EUS. So we're going to talk about both, endobronchial ultrasound and endoscopic ultrasound. Here's a statement by the European Society of GI Endoscopy, Respiratory Society, and the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. And they basically say that any patient who has to undergo mediastinal staging for lung cancer, endosonography is recommended over surgical staging as the initial procedure. Okay, so that's a grade A recommendation. So that's a pretty bold statement, and if you look at the lymph node map, we get a sense of, okay, that makes sense, because if we combine EBUS and EUS together, so here we are combining endosonography, endobronchial and endoscopic ultrasound, they can cover, combined together, they will cover the most of the mediastinal lymph nodes that we need to sample. So we have the upper and lower paratracheals, we have the hilar, we have the subcarinal, we have the lower mediastinum. We can even get liver mets and adrenal mets using the EUS or endoscopic ultrasound. So this is pretty extensive staging using the combination of these two modalities. If we look at some of the data, and we look at the sensitivity of combining EBUS and EUS in determining involvement of the mediastinum in lung cancer, and we see that the sensitivity is pretty high. It ranges from 85% to 96%. I will not comment on the 100% sensitivity. That was a retrospective study. But still, we have high sensitivity. So how does endosonography do compared to mediastinoscopy? Okay, so big question, big landmark trial from JAMA in 2010, and they took around 240 patients. So these patients were assigned to two different groups. All these patients had been evaluated for lung cancer, initial evaluation where they needed the next step of undergoing mediastinal staging. These patients were divided into two groups. One of the groups had to go straight to surgical staging via mediastinoscopy. The other group had to undergo endosonography followed by surgical staging. So endosonography was performed by endoscopic ultrasound first. That was followed by endobronchial ultrasound. If we had positive finding of lymph node involvement, they did not pursue surgical mediastinoscopy for staging. If the results of endosonography were negative, then those patients underwent mediastinoscopy. So the results are quite fascinating, because the combined endosonography followed by surgical staging had a much higher sensitivity and a significantly higher sensitivity compared to surgical staging alone. But the more interesting fact is that they found that 21 patients in the surgical staging group, 21 out of 118, had undergone unnecessary thoracotomies, whereas only 9 of 123 patients underwent unnecessary thoracotomies in the endosonography followed by the surgical staging group. So this is a big trial that opened our eyes into endosonographic staging of lung cancer. So, but here we're talking about doing both. So we have to do EBUS and EUS. So you have to have either a pulmonologist and a GI physician do the staging, or a pulmonologist that can do both. So I like the title of that article out of CHEST, and endobronchial ultrasound and esophageal ultrasound. Just because we can does not necessarily mean we should. So let's look at that map again and see what we can do to simplify our lives as pulmonologists. So if you look at EBUS, that's in black. So everything that is reachable by EBUS is both in black and white. Everything that's reached by EUS is in black, and the dashed or hashed part. EBUS can actually get to the hilar and lobar and inner lobar stations, whereas EUS cannot. EUS, on the contrary, can actually reach the lower mediastinal lymph node station, station 8, station 9, and maybe even go to liver and adrenal mets. So what does that mean? But before I go further, EUS also has one advantage, is in the AP window nodes and station 5. Some of the times, EUS can reach those stations, so that's an extra advantage of EUS. So is that extra advantage of targeting the lymph node at station 5, the targeting the lymph nodes at station 8 and 9, translate into actually a clinically beneficial outcome? So here's a study where that was published in CHEST, where EBUS was performed on old patients and followed by EUS bronchial FNA. So that was the same physician, a pulmonologist, that did it EBUS and followed that with EUS FNA. And the results are surprising, because adding EUS to EBUS change the sensitivity by a non-statistically significant amount. And if we look at that study even closer, those that were diagnosed by EBUS, those 38 patients out of the 45, only three extra patients, so 41 patients, additional patients were diagnosed by adding the EUS. So diagnosing three extra patients, all of them who had positive station 5 lymph node. So yes, we can access more lymph nodes at station 5, 8, and 9, but that did not translate into a higher sensitivity by just adding the EUS to EBUS. Here's another study where they did the combined EBUS-EUS in two different ways. The first way was starting with EBUS. So the patients underwent EBUS followed by EUS. On the second group, the patients were started with an EUS followed by EBUS. And it's an interesting, the results are very interesting, because the sensitivity of EBUS alone did not change much by adding EUS. So it went from 82% to 85%. By adding EUS, while the other group that started with EUS had an original sensitivity of 60% that was statistically significantly increased by adding EBUS. Okay, so starting with EBUS followed by EUS did not change our sensitivity in detecting mediastinal involvement of lung cancer. And actually, the European panel again notes that if the combination of EBUS and EUS is not available, we suggest that EBUS alone is acceptable. Now, the recommendation grade is grade C, but still, they recommend EBUS alone is acceptable. So we get 1 point for that. So now that we saw that EBUS is actually alone can be a first step in diagnosing and staging mediastinal involvement in lung cancer, that was put head-to-head with mediastinoscopy. So in this study, there was a group of patients that were diagnosed with or undergoing workup for lung cancer, and they had to undergo mediastinoscopy. So these patients underwent endobronchial ultrasound. They had to undergo EBUS first, followed by mediastinoscopy, no matter what the EBUS results showed. Okay, so they served as controls for themselves, the patients. So, and the results are interesting because undergoing EBUS, the sensitivity was very similar to the sensitivity of mediastinoscopy of detecting mediastinal involvement in lung cancer. So again, EBUS versus mediastinoscopy sensitivity is pretty similar. Here's another set of data that's a meta-analysis looking at video-assisted mediastinoscopy with a pooled sensitivity in detecting mediastinal involvement of around 0.86. Very similar, a pooled sensitivity of 0.83, very similar to the sensitivity of EBUS transbronchial needle aspiration. So again, EBUS versus mediastinoscopy, very similar sensitivities. So again, going to EBUS first, followed by mediastinoscopy makes a lot of sense. Now there are some questions that arise. So okay, EBUS is fine, but how many passes? Should I sample the lymph node 10 times, 15 times? What, I mean, to get enough sample? Well, not exactly. Three passes are actually enough. So in each nodal station, you only have to sample the node three times to get a high enough sensitivity of 95%. You don't even need to do, if you do four passes, the sensitivity is not increased by much. So three passes enough for EBUS. How about getting materials for molecular testing, which is very important. It's important not to just, like we said earlier, not just to diagnose, but to get more information regarding molecular markers and genetic mutations. Here's one small study, 193 patients that underwent the EBUS-guided FNA of mediastinal lymph nodes. 16 patients actually had a request to get EGFR testing, and the material that was collected by EBUS FNA was adequate in 15 of the 16 requested studies. So that's around 93% of the samples. So again, adequacy of EBUS TBNA sampling for molecular testing is actually quite good. This was also looked at in another study out of Germany and China. And they looked at different modalities of sampling lung tissue. They looked at EBUS FNA, they looked at bronchoscopy or transbronchial biopsies, and they looked at CT core biopsies. And they all had similar, well, actually EBUS had the highest RNA yield for multiple biomarker testing, a little similar to the CT core biopsy and significantly better than the transbronchial biopsies by bronchoscopy. We cannot talk about EBUS and lymph node sampling without talking about ROSE. So what is ROSE? It's rapid on-site cytologic evaluation. So I like this diagram out of a study from Holland, from the Netherlands. So ROSE is the perfect example of interprofessional collaborative work in diagnosing lung cancer. So I am in the bronchoscopy suite, and I'm ready to do my EBUS. And I call pathology, and I request that one of the pathologists, you don't even have to have a pathologist, you can have a technologist or a technician, that comes down and stands with you in the endoscopy suite. And when you get that first pass of that nodal station, you do a quick smear and present it to the pathologist or the technologist who reads it on site. So you're waiting for an answer. And this is amazing because they tell you, well, you're in a lymph node or you're not in a lymph node. You have your diagnosis or you need more samples. Sometimes you just have to insist on having these colleagues with you in the endoscopy suite. And I know in our here in Lebanon, it's not always that easy. So what does rose benefit us? First of all, it increases diagnostic yield, it decreases the number of needle passes, makes sense, and it decreases the need for additional diagnostic procedures. Here's a study by Oki and colleagues, and they looked at two groups of patients that underwent endoscopy or endobronchial ultrasound biopsies with the presence of rose versus non-rose, or no presence of on-site cytology. And the mean number of passes was evidently lower, and significantly lower by one pass at least, in the group that had rose present. And the patients that underwent the procedure without the presence of on-site cytology had to undergo additional procedures. Most of these procedures actually were sampling other lymph node stations, okay? And there was a statistical significant difference among the number of additional procedures required. Funny enough, the bronchoscopy time is not different between the two groups. The sensitivity is not enough, and is not different, and the specificity is not different. So this is the latest guidelines by the ACCP or the CHEST College on EBUS regarding rose or the use of rose. So in patients undergoing EBUS TBNA for diagnostic evaluation, we recommend that tissue sampling can be performed with or without rapid on-site evaluation. So if we're not having it here in Lebanon, it's okay. We can do it without. And I think this is the most important slide in the whole presentation, because diagnosing and staging lung cancer is not about one doctor. It's not about one physician. It's not about one specialty. It's about all the specialties that you see here and even more in coming together and finding the best way and the best strategy to diagnose, to stage that patient, and in the least stressful way for the patient and the least invasive way possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Rami, for this excellent presentation. I will now open the floor for questions.
Just a quick question, also technical. You didn't mention if 21 versus 22 needle steel versus other kind of needle will do any difference, because we're having a hard time with pathologists as far as telling us about the biomarkers after sampling the nodes.
So excellent question, actually. And we've always wondered if a 22-gauge needle is different from 21-gauge needle. The jury's still out, and actually the studies have not shown a better yield with the 21 versus the 22. So it's whatever we have, and sometimes I think we need more studies to define the advantage of using a larger gauge needle. But today, as we speak right now, there is no advantage to either one. I think we get molecular testing with enough tissue for molecular testing with either 22 or 21. That said, yes, we do have a lot of problems, at least with molecular testing with our pathologists. We don't have the 19-gauge needle that EUS has, unfortunately. We don't have core in our EBUSes, and I don't know if we'll ever get it, but if we do, that would be a big advantage. And I think it's a learning curve for us and how to sample, and for our pathologists here that are still not used to us giving them a 22-gauge sample to run molecular tests on it. So,
hi, Rami. Excellent talk, actually. Loved it. First, maybe a comment. First, we do have the stacking technique where you can actually get a core. And interestingly enough, they're doing it with a 25-gauge needle and showing the same results with the 21 and the 22. So the size is clearly not an issue anymore. So you can do the slow pull technique instead of the vacuum technique, and you can get much more tissue out of it. My problem with the genetic testing is that sometimes you do hit the node, you know you're inside of it, and you get the diagnosis, but you don't have enough cells. And that's been a problem. Sometimes you send it you send it for core biopsy, with the Cytotec, and they spin it down, and still they cannot get enough cells. Have you had, so this is why sometimes, even though I have the diagnosis, I go more than three passes to get more samples and then send it for molecular testing.
Excellent point to start with, and then the question again. The one of the studies actually showed that you don't need a lot of cells for molecular testing. And comparing the results that I've been having here versus the results that I've been having in the U.S., we rarely got a non-diagnostic or not enough cells from EBUS. So like I said, I think it's a learning curve. And all you need is actually 100 cells. The mean number of cells is around 400 to get 400 cells to get the to get a comfortable diagnosis. But as little as 100 cells in the study that I mentioned was enough to get adequate sample for molecular testing. So again, I think it's a learning process, and I'm sure we'll get there. The more EBUSes we do, the faster we get there.
No, I have a question, Rami. Is there a specific number of procedures that have to be done yearly in order to maintain your competence in performing this procedure?
So a lot of the ACCP or CHEST has also, and the European Society, they've all discussed the need to have an actual training program for that and to continue doing a lot of procedures. And the number is somewhere around 20 procedures a year.
Yeah.
But that's up in the air.
Okay.
I think it's both.
Say I have 100 and there is no diagnosis. Is it my problem or the pathologist?
So it's if you are actually in, if you have a diagnosis and you have cells, 100 cells, you should be able, the pathologist should be able to give you a diagnosis. Of course, we're not going to point fingers, but we'll take some of that blame as well. Maybe we can improve the technique. I think the stacking technique that Wajdi just mentioned is one of the ways to increase your, to do a pseudocore if we want, to get a nice chunk of cells. Plus, we do a lot of our testing. We put a lot of our samples into cell blocks. That can help also. So just to note as well, even the CHEST guidelines say that in case you need to send for molecular testing, you do, so it's three passes to diagnose, but you need more passes to actually do the molecular testing. So you do your three passes, then if you know you're going to send for a molecular testing, you have to do a few more passes, okay? And the range is between around 3 to 5 passes to get your molecular testing as well. I don't have a definite answer regarding, because you don't want to point fingers, but I think it's a learning curve for pathologists and us as well.
Any more questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ram.
Thank you.